Welcome to After the Deluge. I'm Justin Cox. Transgender Dysphoria Blues is Against Me's sixth studio album, and it's their first after their major label deal with Sire Records. It was released on January 21st, 2014 on Total Treble and Extra Mile Recordings, and it debuted at 23 on the Billboard 200, their highest debut ever. Okay, so this series was always barreling toward two major targets. The first was New Wave, which we covered a few episodes back with Ben Lee, and the second is this record, Transgender Dysphoria Blues, which turns 10 years old as of the week that I'm recording this in January 2024. I'm going to try and mostly stay out of the way in this intro, but let's set the scene real quick. They're off the major label, and they released this one on their own. After two records with Butch Vig, Laura Jane Grace produces this one all by herself. They scrap the first set of demos, and then they later scrap a near-completed version of the record after Jay Weinberg, then future, now former drummer of Slipknot, quits the band. And then sometime after that, longtime bassist Andrew Seward departs as well. Ultimately, they head to California and make the record in San Francisco, with Fat Mike playing bass on a few of the songs. And then, of course, we have the Rolling Stone article. The Secret Life of Transgender Rocker Laura Jane Grace reads the headline. And on the cover of the print edition, The Secret Life of the Rock Star Who Became a Woman, right next to a headshot of Peter Dinklage and sandwiched between stories about Occupy Wall Street and Adam Lambert. This is 2012. My guest today is Casey Plett, author of A Dream of a Woman, Little Fish, and A Safe Girl to Love. Her latest book is called On Community, and she's also the publisher at Little Puss Press. I trust myself to make a very smart and thoughtful show when I do this podcast, and I think I've done a good job with this season and the seasons prior and all of that. I'm kind of loose with all that. But I'd be lying if I didn't admit that I was a little nervous about fucking this one up in some kind of specific way, you know? It was always kind of sitting there as I made the series. I felt pretty good about it, but, you know, it had a little extra thing to it. Kind of like what Steak Mountain said in the last episode. It's like, this album is more than an album. There's something more going on there, and I don't want to fuck it up. I want to try and rise to that. And this conversation with Casey was loose and effortless, and I loved it, and I hope you do too. We start with the Rolling Stone story, and then we spin forth from there. If this is the first time you're hearing this podcast, you should go back and check out some earlier episodes. We've got all the Against Me records covered, and we got a full season about Bright Eyes. Got a bunch of good guests you might like, including Connor Oberst, Tim Kasher, Frank Turner, a lot of music writers, all that kind of stuff. You can reach me at delugepodcast@gmail.com or find me on social media at Routine Layup. Here is my conversation about Transgender Dysphoria Blues on its 10th birthday with author Casey Plett. The Rolling Stone article, do you remember where you were when you read it?
Yeah, there's a few things. So one, you know January Hunt, who's in the article?
Yeah.
Yeah, and like helped Laura come out. Like about a month before, I was at a book reading in New York, and she was there. She said something like, I forget what it was, but she said, somebody is about to come out as trans, and it's like, I can't say more than that, but like, you know, I'll be paraphrasing, but like, it's somebody really famous and like a big deal, and it's gonna be like kind of wild. And I was like, okay, cool, whatever, you know. I didn't really think much about it, and then a month later I remember I saw the Rolling Stone article on Facebook come out, and I was just like logging on, and I was just like getting ready for work, because and you know, at the time I hadn't really thought about Against Me for years. I mean, I'd been around them sort of in my adolescence. They were like the first two albums were like in the air, you know.
Your background is that you had experience with punk at a like a real younger phase of your life, but that had been years had passed since then, right?
Yeah, in high school. And even though like Against, like I went to high school between 2001 and 2005, so like Against Me was doing stuff during there, but they just never totally crossed my radar. Which is just kind of happenstance, I think. But I remember like in college, like this girl I had a crush on like had the lyric had like Against Me lyrics in her AIM away message.
Love it.
Yeah, for really old school throwback there. And then also, you know, there was this guy in one of the co-ops of my roommates who he would like put on Baby I'm an Anarchist and just kind of like sitting with his buddies in like the co-op kitchen, like stuff like that. They were in the fabric of my like existence.
I can picture that so easily. I can picture the baby. I'm an anarchist guy.
Yeah, yeah. 21. He loved it. He was having such a good time. He's yeah. And that was like 20 years ago. I still have a very clear picture of it. And then yeah, when the Rolling Stone article came out, I was like, whoa, like that's, you know, whatever I was expecting when, you know, January said that, I don't think I was expecting her. You know, and, you know, I got really emotional. I looked at the pictures that she, that was on, were on her, that were accompanied with that photo shoot for a long time. You know, obviously at the time, Transgender Dysphoria Blues wasn't out yet. And I feel my friends were talking about the ocean, you know, which is the most, like you said, the breadcrumb thing. That's like the most visible.
Yeah, yeah.
Breadcrumb in her earlier Uber, right? Like listening to it over and over and over, and I was crying a little bit. And then so that's the first memory. And then there's a couple other memories I have of the Rolling Stone article. The second one, I was working at the Strand at the time, this big bookstore in New York City, and somebody, I think it was a coincidence too, I don't think I actually bought the Rolling Stone magazine, but it was like in the break room. In the break room there was a copy of it, and the headline was like rock star who becomes a woman or something. And so then yeah. I read it on paper as well. And I again remember being very moved by that. And then a little while later, I was at this social gathering with a bunch of other trans women, and somehow, and the issue was also on the table. And someone was like, and then somebody, I remember making fun of that headline, like rock star who becomes a woman, as if, you know, the categories of rock star and woman like had a strange overlap, of course. But I hadn't thought about that before. You know, I was young. I was very sort of like budding feminist kind of. I was like, oh, whoa, yeah. Like, oh, dang.
How funny. That's so good.
Yeah, right. And then, so I, you know, I listened to a little bit more of the Against Feedback catalog, and, you know, it obviously had like, to me, those like the bearded baby, I'm an anarchist guy, you know, and the trans life I was living didn't always sort of seem like separate things, you know. And yeah, and when Transgender Dysphoria Blues came out, I immediately downloaded and listened to it over and over and over. And I went to See Against Me in Winnipeg when they came around in the spring of 2014. The funny thing is now is that, you know, even though Transgender Dysphoria Blues was certainly like, it's a great album, and I still like it quite a lot, but even I still listen to some of like, that's not like the Against Me album I tend to listen to most of the time, like, or like New Wave, or like White Crosses. That's kind of more that's where my sweet spot sort of lies. But it was a really important album for me for sure. And I like, you know, I was living in Winnipeg. I was working retail. I was trying to write my first book. And I had just come out still. I was like, maybe like year two, year three, the transitioning. I was like pretty kind of isolated, kind of angry. I was drinking a lot.
So I kind of found you by way of a piece you wrote in Defector about like hormone replacement therapy in like around 2010. So 2012 is a Rolling Stone article. 2014 is Transgender Dysphoria Blues. That just kind of orients us in time. I want to go to the record itself and the show you went to because you wrote you published kind of like, it's not even like you wrote something years later. You published the kind of journal entries of going to a show. So I fully want to go to that because I think it's a fascinating window into that moment for that band and her in general and everything. But I real quick, just
cool, please do.
I can remember, it's one of those weird things. Cause I loved this band. I was like really, really, I was essentially the fucking baby. I'm an anarchist guy in the kitchen. Kind
amazing.
Of
amazing. Amazing.
You know, but and then, you know, like they had a complicated, they've lived like three lives really. Like so they signed to major labels and people decided to be self-important. Like that was still a time when it'd be like, how dare they do that or whatever.
Totally.
And I had like this real deep history with this band, but then also maybe was on a little bit of like had a little bit of distance kind of in that moment. And I can remember I lived in an apartment, Davis, California. I guess I had an iPhone. my wife and I lived in a little apartment, just had a baby. And I remember walking and like walking and scrolling your phone or whatever. And I don't know if it was Facebook. Mm-hmm. I don't know what social network it would have been in 2012, but just seeing it and like stopping and probably reading mm-hmm. the first 5-10 minutes of it, like just standing up in that spot. Like I can remember where I was standing and just thinking like some feeling of like, I'm reading and I'm learning right now. And I know that this is very important. This is significant. Mm-hmm. Like, and I didn't know anything beyond that. It was like, I'm going to learn a lot more about this by way of this story that I'm reading right now. This feels trivial to say, but I think that's before timeline wise. Is that before Caitlyn Jenner? Like,
definitely before. Yeah.
If you're not in that world, you're learning some new stuff in a new way in that point by way of like literally one of your favorite bands. And I remember sitting down on the couch, reading that whole thing. And just like, I went back and listened to those other songs too. Cause you're sitting there reading this article and you're like, on one hand, those are like things that are quietly tucked into old songs, but like The Ocean, Searching for a Former Clarity, The Disco Before the Breakdown, Laura Jane Grace on Against Me Records is not always singing in a way that has you hanging on every word and hearing them exactly. You can hear the lyrics in those songs. They're right there for you, right?
Yeah, totally.
Just a vivid memory, and then remember similar thing, like was really, it felt like an equally big deal when this record eventually came out.
Yeah.
I saw them again later one time, but I didn't see them on that tour. Let's go back to Canada and you see them. I think the album came out in January and your journal might have said April or so.
It was April of 2014, yeah.
Okay. So what was the show like?
It was at the West End Cultural Center, which is a rehab church in Winnipeg. And another funny cross, you know, I remember thinking like, wow, there's so many people here. There's so many people who are coming out for this band that is fronted by a trans woman. That's amazing. But also, like I said, you know, I wasn't super into Against Me beforehand. And I'd been out of the punk scene for a few years. And so a friend of mine I work with who is there, she was like, oh, you know, the last time Against Me came to Winnipeg, they played the Garrick. And the Garrick is a venue about like double the size. What I didn't know is that I was going to this venue and I was like amazed how many people were there. And I was like, you know, the last time they came here, they filled a place that was twice the size. And I was like, well, okay. Also kind of goes to speak.
That really jumped out to me too. It's like, because on one hand, what I just described is a Rolling Stone article and a sort of like, whoa, this feels like even while a like swirl of attention happened and something, they're playing a venue half the size on the tour.
Yeah.
Like it's like really interesting to think about what that means or how that.
Yeah. It's strange. Right.
Yeah.
And it sort of ties into what you said about how this band has had so many different lives.
Right. I think that there's something in there about like Transgender Dysphoria Blues above all else is about, it spells out what it's about in the title.
Yeah.
But it's also simultaneously does this other thing, which is, okay, we've made two records on a major label with the guy who produced Nirvana's Nevermind that sound like about as slick and shooting for the stars as you could possibly be. And now they've made one. Again, its primary purpose is in its title, but also it's a 25-minute punk record, self-produced, and it's gesturing back to some older thing as well, like sonically and in its approach and everything. Even I could be choosing to read too much into it, but like those first drum sounds that it does, which are just like you're in the moment you hear that, you know? Same thing can be true for track one on their record, Reinventing Axl Rose, Pints of Guinness Make You Strong, starts with this like iconic drum shuffling thing that may be coincidental, maybe not. I don't know. But I do feel like this record is doing both of those things at this little
point. Yeah, that's a good point. I haven't thought about that. That makes a lot of sense. I don't want to read into too much to Laura. You know, I don't know Laura. We've never interacted. So I don't want to read too much into how she would have gone about this, but it would make a lot of sense to me that, you know, like you said, you do a couple albums like that and then you do something like, especially in 2012, when you really didn't know how much that was going to go. I mean, like I was always sort of touched by how much of wider punk community sort of seemed to be down with Laura Jane. Like I wasn't expecting that at all, you know? And I mean, which is not to say that was like universal or that it was, you know, whatever, that transphobia doesn't exist in punk scenes, blah, blah, blah. Of course, we all know that's the case. But still, you know, in early 2012, I was totally prepared for everyone just like, and happened. But the thing is, then it's kind of cool to think like, you know, you do those kind of two albums and you're like, okay, like, well, why am I doing this? I guess, you know, especially if you do something as insane as like come out as trans on a world stage in a fucking Rolling Stone article, which is so wild. Then like, well, what do you make next with your art? Like, you're probably going to be more in touch with like why you started doing the whole thing in the first place. Right. So.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
And also, I mean, that show that I went to, yeah, it was half the venue size and also everyone loved it, you know, and like the bands were clearly like old fans. They were like going more nuts to the older stuff, but everyone was down with the newer stuff too. And like, it was such an energetic and just like vibrant and live wire show. Like it was very, you know, the entire crowd was into it. So even though I was sort of mystified by it at the time, I was like, wow, is this kind of a new world we're entering? Maybe this is like a new world we're entering. You know, I wasn't expecting this.
You describe it well in your journal that it's like, yeah, it's not like people were like actively shunning new songs. They're into new songs and they're listening and they're into Transgender Dysphoria Blues. But if you go from that into Baby, I'm an Anarchist, like you got years under your, like in your soul that just come out in that moment and your body moves in a certain way. And that's what it is. But I don't know. It actually transitions to something. Well, your recent book is called On Community, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I haven't read it, but I listened to a bit of a conversation you had on a week or so ago.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, that if I'm at an Against Me show or if I'm at anything, I alone am not like some stand-in representative for all of the insert blank thing people in such and such community, in the same way that
yeah, totally.
Any collection of trans people at an Against Me show is not going to be that either. But I can remember at the time wondering like, this has to inevitably bring out people to this punk band's shows that would not be going. There's not enough examples of, I mean, this is in Rolling Stone magazine, you know, and did it feel that way? Like, again, I don't want to say like, oh, the trans community was at the Against Me shows. Now it's more, more nuanced than that, but I don't know.
I think sort of like yes and no, and it like took some time. Like one thing that's interesting, like I went, as I wrote in the journal article, I went with like I think two or three other trans friends, and we were wondering if we'd see others there, but we didn't really. And like Winnipeg, you know, it's a city of about like 600,000-700,000 people, but even at the time, you know, we tended to know each other, so I was sort of surprised by that. But also then something has happened in the interim years where I feel like I've known a lot of trans people who have now like grown up listening to Against Me, or like transitioned years after Laura Jane did, you know, or who an album like Transgender Dysphoria Blues was formative for them in their much younger years. Like that's a thing that definitely happened that I can say for sure.
Yeah.
What's interesting about the thing about that show is that it was sort of at an inflection point where again there were maybe like three or four of us there, and we were the only ones who are trans that I could lie at least saw and recognize. It's not too dissimilar. Do you know, have you heard of the book Nevada by Imogen Binney?
I have not.
Yeah. So it was it's a novel that came out exactly a year, had come out exactly a year beforehand in 2013. And it was by this trans woman, and it was like this old punk who was sort of like, her life wasn't good together, and she like is trying to like figure her life out, and she's like transitioned like a decade ago, and she was like an old punk musician, and she's like, well, old, she's like 30 in the book, but has like a sort of like a teenage punk history. It's a funny book. She like quits her job, she like gets fired from her job, steals a bunch of heroin, like drives out west. Anyway, it was a very seminal and important book also in a lot of trans literary scenes, and specifically about punk stuff and about like getting away from a certain narrative that in order to be trans and you had to fit some very sort of like old archetype of femininity or had to be hypersexual or that kind of thing. So it's interesting to think that Transgender Dysphoria Blues sort of came out in that similar moment where there was like a trans punk thing happening. Like a few things happened around that time period culturally, that nearly a decade on, I feel like I can see the effect of, like, I can see people, again, I can see people who grew up with Transgender Dysphoria Blues. I can see people for whom they knew of Against Me and knew of Laura Jane like after this all happened.
Yeah.
But at that time, at that show, that hadn't really fed through yet.
It really is true that like what you're seeing is one little small slice sample at in Winnipeg, basically, right? Like it was,
yeah.
Yeah, I think that played out over time. the part where the show ends, like there's nothing weirder than the vibe in an emptying venue, you know, like when there's not music happening in a venue, you don't want to fucking be in that. It's like, and it's just weird and feels wrong. And you describe, like, I mean, you could say it, but like what might be pills scattered on the floor, but
yeah,
breath mints.
Yeah. Yeah. They're clearly, and I was like pretty drunk when this happened, but they were like clearly breath mints in retrospect. But there were these tiny blue pills, which looked a lot like what estrogen pills look like. And I remember my friend and I being like, oh my God, like this has to belong to someone. And I think we, you know, I have a feeling that we wanted really badly for there to be other people like us who we hadn't known or hadn't met.
It's very pure in its spirit and intention. Like, we have to gather these up. These could be somebody's. And then it's just funny that they were breath mints. And you put them in a little pile on a table.
Yeah, I just like, oops. And I just like put them, there's like an empty cup. And I just like kept them in there. Yeah.
I just crawled around on a nasty venue floor after a show to collect these breath mints and put them in.
I know, I did. It was like, it's wild to remember that happened. You know, it's the kind of thing where if I hadn't written that down at the time, I would be like, did that happen? No, that can't have happened. I'd be making that shit up. There's no way that was true.
It's good. And then I think after that, you're like, oh, maybe we'll see Laura, whatever. But it's like, person from Florida in Winnipeg in like the ends of winter. That person's probably not hanging out.
Exactly. That person is definitely chilling somewhere warm. Yeah, and it was still real. It was still, it was definitely still real winter there. As it gets there, sometimes we were like walking around the venue.
So like going to the album, I'm curious where you land on this, because I could listen to this album and think all of these songs are about this process of transitioning and processing all of it, or I could listen to it, and I think I have at times, as if half of them are and half of them are not. Like, I think there's room, and I don't actually know the answer. I mean, I've done some sort of like looking up and people commenting on the meaning of things, but I don't know. Like, clearly Transgender Dysphoria Blues and True Trans Soul Rebel and some of these ones, but then you listen to like ones about what looks like Sleeping Baby, and Black Me Out is a good one. I absolutely love that song, and I think it's only up until like preparing for this episode that I started to see it through the lens of like, I thought it was about major label type stuff, you know. Listening to it, one thing you said in one of your pieces is that one of your favorites was Fuck My Life 666. Is that still true of this record?
Yeah, I love that song. You know, I'm already just a skeleton.
I think that one is kind of describing her wife at the time, and like the ideals of femininity and things like that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think one thing that's super interesting is to consider like the ways in which, like, I also too, you know, will listen to that album and don't necessarily think of explicitly transition related things, but there's like a both and thing there that I find. I mean, there's something this album is just about like getting older and age, and also like, you know, especially if you've been like looking back after like 10 or whatever decade years in a punk scene and been like, oh shit. Like, I think about the song Dead Friend, right? Where like, it is unfortunately a very trans experience to be like, there's somebody I met when they were really young and now they're dead. But also like, those trans people tend to die at younger ages. And also there's just a thing where like, there's plenty of people who, when you get older, you all of a sudden there's, you know, that's just like a part of like life, right?
That's a great point. I mean, when in writing and in artistic expression and everything, the idea, the people who are doing it the best are making something, there's like a process of them making and them putting something out, and then you then have the process of consuming. And when that's done at its best, that's a
an active and exciting part of the process. And so like, here's a prescript, here's me saying exactly everything, exactly, literally, it's going to, that can really strongly appeal to a specific person. But I think part of the power in this record is that it allows you to do that. Like the chorus, I mean, it Transgender Dysphoria Blues, the first song, the title of the record, the chorus is "Rough Surf on the Coast. I wish I could have spent the whole day alone." That's unbelievable. And that is not that, that is leaving you with a ton of work and interpretation and stuff to swim around in and think about. Right.
Totally.
And I think Against Me does that. I feel like I say this every episode, but it's like Against Me does that when they talk about politics. They do that when they talk about the economics of record labels. They do that when they talk about someone dying. Like it's a, beyond like the specific subject matter of this record, she's just a gifted writer in that way.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And it's beautiful to think of that. If I think about that as an artist, I mean, I think one of the coolest and most beautiful things about making art is that you make something and someone else can consume it and be like, oh yeah, you're totally talking about this. And you as an artist can be like, no, but that also doesn't mean you're wrong, right? Like, yeah. I find one of the coolest things about being as a fiction writer is that I can publish something and someone can be say like, you know, when you wrote this thing, I completely thought about X, Y, Z. And I'll be thinking, well, I was thinking about A, B, C, but also, you know, I was maybe clearly tapping to something else, or there was something about my own work that I didn't realize.
I love that. Are you saying you do like that?
Yeah. I love that a bunch. I love that. I find that powerful. I find it moving, honestly.
So,
you know?
So do I. But I don't like, This is a real zag and maybe not one I should take, but like when I hear about like the wrong type of person taking the wrong type of message from like Fight Club or something like that, I'm not letting that, I'm not going to let that make me not like Fight Club. Fuck that. That's, I get it. I get what you mean, but it is part of the process is, I mean, I guess what that gets at though, is that this process of misinterpreting can go horribly too.
That's true. That's a good point.
Again, and misinterpreting is maybe the wrong word and maybe that's a different thing, but like, I don't know, you're a fiction writer and a great writer. And I think the best writing, if someone loves someone, they don't say, "Hey, I love you." That's just you move people through some action or set of words that makes the person think, "Hey, I think this person loves this person." And so like Rough Surf on the Coast, I wish I could have spent the whole day alone. I think almost anyone can find the feelings that she's getting at there. This will probably make some sense to you. And I know it did to me because I remember you listening to it and it's like, you hear all these songs, like certain ones feel like they're like first person, like getting it out there, say proclaiming like her personal feelings in this process. And then some are like third person stories of other people. And they almost seem kind of, those are some of like the most big sounding songs, like True Trans Soul Rebel and Paralytic States. And they feel like, they're sort of tragic, some of them, but they're like big kind of theatrical feeling songs almost. And I think what was happening there was like the band existed and she started writing songs. I think she says it in the book or I read it elsewhere, but she starts writing songs, but she's not writing the, I'm telling my personal story of being trans yet. She's writing these things that have some distance, these things that are telling that story, but they're not her. And so it starts off as like, that until it becomes what it ultimately becomes. And she talks to the band and she talks to everyone about comes out and everything, which is really fascinating and really explains that like there's just a different feel to the way she goes about talking about this process on various songs on the record.
But what you say that reminds me of, I always think the dynamic you're describing, I always think of that with like the song Thrash Unreal. I know we're going to like a different record now, you know, but I feel like it's describing somebody else and it's describing somebody else's story. And also you can't help but also read in a little bit of her as well. And there's like a synergy going on there.
Yeah, it's true. She's got a gift for, I'm going to tell you a really sad story about a person. I'm going to sing you a tragedy right now.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Certain stuff like can feel, you feel deep sympathy and like like when you want to be a good person or a helpful person, but, and you read things like, even if your love was unconditional, it still won't be enough to save me, is like, it's one of those kinds of things that's like, all you can do is feel the sadness of that and not really know what to do. Don't really have a question with that, except that it's tough. Even if your love is unconditional, even if your love is unconditional.
I remember loving when I heard that song on that record too. Honestly, that you just reminded me of this. When I remember hearing that song, I remember thinking like, okay, this album's going to be real. Also, I think there is a lot of pressure sometimes on trans artists when one makes one's first thing to be a little more like uplifting or a little more kind of like have like get go, you know. And the first two songs, obviously, Transgender Dysphoria Blues and True Trans Soul Rebel, are not that they like, they're pretty real, but you know, they have like a lot of spring in their step. And Unconditional Love is so like, okay, right, like this is going to be a bit of a bleak album, and that's like fine, that's like the kind of thing I sort of like need at the moment.
You saying spring in your step makes it so I can't gloss over no cunt in your strut.
Excellent catch. I did not think about that at all. You're so right.
Which is just, as far as like, there's something really cool is in songwriting when you like, you've had a verse, you've had a chorus, we've heard this song, it's going, and now we're going to verse two, and you get hit with that line, is it's fucking, it's really good. You've got no cunts in your strut. You've got no hips to shake. But I totally agree with the point you were just making. I don't know if this band is necessarily capable of making the, we're here to just pep you up all the way through. I don't think they're, totally. I think across the board too complex for that. But I thought it was fun that you noted Drinking with the Jocks, which is like, you basically noted, not, it's probably the one you're most inclined to skip. How are you feeling
it's like,
about
it? It's still the one I skip.
The way I see it, the way I see that song is it's like, it's in the punk tradition of, we're going to like throw knives for 2 minutes really fast and get through. And like, that's like what it, that's, it's because it is, it's like, it's kind of gnarly. Like, oh, when I sing along, if you sing along with it, it's like, oh my God. But I do like the sort of like, we're at the middle of the record almost, and we're just going to like slam the pedal down for 2 minutes and then we'll be back in a second. Mm-hmm. But it is, it's a weird one. I thought it was funny that in your journal they played it in the encore, which on one hand I'm like, that's random, like it doesn't seem, I wonder if they even play it now, but also it'll make it, it moves fast and hits hard, and so maybe that's all it takes, you know.
Yeah, and everyone fucking exploded for that one. And also, I mean, they had just left with the ocean, so they had left on sort of a very melancholy note, so
damn, they did. So that the last interview I did, which hasn't come out, I might put it out today maybe, but is with the artist who designed the record cover of White Crosses, designed this Transgender Dysphoria Blues record cover. His name is Steak Mountain. But he was talking about the ocean, and the way he talked about the ocean, which I thought was pretty amazing, was that it was like, I mean, in addition to everything that it's saying, that it sounded like an Against Me song from the future, like a thing that they would have written 10 years later, both in terms of the way they're reflecting and the way it sounds and everything. And then I think even said, I mean, maybe he saw him and just knew this, but it's the song you end with, knowing that you're going to hit them with a couple more of the things, but it's like, it's what you end with, exactly what you said they did in Winnipeg.
Yeah.
But I thought that was cool.
Yeah. From the future. That makes a lot of sense.
I've been really delighted with the way it's played out in this podcast, is to go like, you're talking about reinventing Axl Rose. You're talking about As the Eternal Cowboy, and these little moments where she has basically said lines like, confessing childhood secrets of dressing up in women's clothes, to what she, if I could have chosen, I would have been born a woman, to some more like nuanced stuff that you, it's a little dangerous to be like, oh, now I'm just going to read into all of these lyrics from the past and decide they were about this. Like maybe they were, maybe they weren't, I don't know, but I don't know. I don't want to be simplistic with this, but is there some level of like, Have you had any experience with like some level of like, I'm putting this out there in these little ways to like offer it up for other people to do the work of helping bring this up. So it's not like the process of coming to terms with this or transitioning, I guess. I don't know. It feels purposeful. Maybe part of that's just venting feelings, but part of that feels like she said it literally on records multiple times before being like, I'm going to make one fully called Transgender Dysphoria Blues now and just tell the whole story, you know?
Totally. I mean, I think it would make sense to be like, you know, I'm going to put this out there and I wonder how people will respond to it, right? Yeah. I remember like one time she was doing an interview at the Ocean, and then I don't know if it was her bandmates or there was somebody who was always like, what's this about? And then she was like, I don't know, I was really stoned. Like that was the end of that conversation. Really?
Nah, that's
Yeah. I gotta find that at some point. I definitely remember reading that somewhere. And I think there's something to like, especially if you're working in a medium like songwriting, or of course I personally think of for fiction writing, where if there's something about you or your life that you are not extremely jazzed about being super open about or discussing, then you can insert it into your art somewhere. And that's almost like a way for you to see how people react, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't even necessarily think there's something, I actually think that there's something about that that could make good art. Like, I don't think there's anything cowardly about that, even if it may perhaps sound that way. I remember when the first time I saw the video for Thrash Unreal, it was after Laura Jade had come out. I was like,
yeah,
you know, like, obviously, again, this is a story about some other woman who presumably is not Laura Jane, but also like the way that video is shot and the way the song is, you can't help but think of the breadcrumb thing again.
Yeah.
And I think there's something like really rich about that. I think there's something like really artistically powerful.
I agree. I mean, I've thought often about like when I make this podcast, it's like oftentimes an excuse. I mean, we're not just going like liner notes in and just like Wikipedia style talking about the records and songs. It's a little bit of like a vessel to talk about other things. Like, and
yeah,
every single time it's like, it's going to find its way toward politics and culture and like community and all of that. And, you know, I'm not sitting and just like writing essays about my personal feelings about all these things, but this as a way to go about like talking about them and processing them and learning from other people about them and stuff. It's super valuable. And that's gotta be what's happening in those songs.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's things, and again, to move away from trans stuff for a little bit, I mean, there's stuff about like death and mourning and addiction and like loss, right? That are, you know, things that sometimes you can't look at head on, but you can maybe look at them with music.
And a lot of times it's like people don't want to look at those things head on, and it's not like you're tricking them, but it's like, it's a lot of what art is doing, right? Is getting you those messages in other ways, whether it's a movie painting or, it's interesting. You talk about like what I was saying earlier about like, you can listen to this record and decide it's a full thing about being transgender, or you could like find other meanings in certain stuff. But like Dead Friend, like that song, kind of like the impetus for that song is a friend, a lighting guy who worked on their tour that died in like a lighting, like fell off a thing.
Oh, and then shit, I didn't
had
know
to
that.
Get rehabbed. So it's like, I don't think you're telling that story in the way she tells it on this record and putting it on Transgender Dysphoria Blues if you're not like also opening and inviting this broad interpretation of it, you know? And
totally.
And also like there's the line in there about that guy, which this was like an eccentric guy on the tour that was like, they just had a connection, and Laura Jane Grace's wife had a connection with, and was really, really affected when the guy died. And the line, the most real person that I've ever met. I think there's a certain level of like this, if you're a person who's not being the full real version of what, of how you feel, and you meet this person who simply, we've all met these people in our life. It's like, damn, you don't give a fuck at all. You're literally not considering how you're perceived at all. You simply are. Like, sometimes it's like, maybe you should a little bit, but also but above all that, like, I think I've had the feeling when I've met people like that, it's like, damn, what a way to, there's something to pull from that. And I don't know, it's choosing to interpret, but if you're a person, if you're Laura Jane Grace in 2009, a few years away from this moment and this record, I could see that meaning something, you know?
Yeah, you're probably not wrong. When you died, you were only 26, the most real person that I've ever met. Well, how could I not have guessed? You would fall in love with the first when she kissed in a casket. Fall in love with the first when she kissed in a casket. Fall in love with the first when she kissed in a casket. God damn it.
I think another one you talked about that like gave you, I think you felt active emotion at the show and everything is Paralytic States, which is another one of these. What is it about that song that hits you?
I mean, to me, it's also like, it's hard not to think about like self-harm and suicide, you know, with that. Yeah. And I mean, it comes only a couple tracks after Dead Friend too. So like, I feel like there's sort of like a resonance that the record is building up to with that song, yeah. You know? And I just got like such, I have such a really powerful image of like being in a shitty motel and probably being too drunk or too high. And they're just like fighting and violence around you and then like, and sex. I don't know. It sort of feels like, again, like it feels like what the whole record is building towards to me, you know, yeah. Black Me Out. I love Black Me Out too. I love it a bunch, but it almost feels like an outro, you know, like it kind of feels like the release of breath.
Damn. I love that. You're right about that.
And Paralytic States is sort of just like,
When it kicks into the chorus of Paralytic States, it's like, it's, I mean, the song is dark and gritty and just feels that way. But then I don't think I have seen that song live, but that would be a awesome song to see live. She could hear them fucking through those thin hotel walls. She heard babies crying, she heard laughter, she heard sirens. End with those, like, I think my feeling is I like the beginning and the end of the record more than the middle. I don't know if that's a common thing, but those last two songs ending with those last two songs is like, Against Me does this well often. I think it's, they don't just like front load the hits. They quite often will put, I mean, I think one of the records, the lead single was like the second to last song, which is, I don't think that common. Black Me Out, like, I guess Laura Jane Grace has said, it might be in the book as well, that like Black Me Out is addressing all of this same stuff, which once I read it that way, I could see it. But like, I think as a person who lived through them signing to a major label and then coming off the label and that being all complicated and everything. And they have this song Tonight, We're Going to Give It 35%, which is like written real early on while they're starting to get courted by major labels and everything like that, where they're describing like, we drank bottled water together and talked business. I think I made the right moves. Like, it's kind of describing what feels to me like A&R business guy trying to sign them and tell them about their big thing they could become and everything. And I just felt like that. I just always interpreted this song as like, I want to chop your brass rings off your fat fucking finger. And like, you're like fat cat business person. I think you still can. Like you said, you get to interpret how you want to interpret it. But once I like kind of took this thing in as a package again and thinking about the, like, I can see it not being about that. I could see it being about both. I could see, I mean, I don't know. Either, regardless, amazing song. I don't ever want to talk that way again. I don't want to know people like that anymore. As if there was an obligation. As if I owed you something. Trying to ask this right, but on one hand, this album comes out 10 years ago and that Rolling Stone article comes out 12 years ago. So on one hand, that's the earlier you do something, the more sort of like foreign or maybe shocking or whatever. So I would say if someone came now, it probably wouldn't be as shocking. We would have more context. We'd have more like understanding. And yet it actually would probably be, I'm trying to think about now versus then, it probably would actually be more charged with shit, you know, charged like full of really, really like not fun discourse and dialogue. And I mean, maybe it's just because it's like entered the world of politics, but like, I don't know. I don't want to ask like this big umbrella question, but like, where are we at now compared to 10 years ago on this?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, man. I mean, like, I sometimes think about that moment a lot because up until that point, I mean, there's always been queer punk, there's always been trans punk, but that's always been like underground within an underground, you know? And I think like, when Laura Jane came out, that was the first time that in like more like mainstream punk circles or mainstream alt rock stuff that you had like, you know?
And once you're talking Rolling Stone, yeah, exactly. You're even beyond punk circles.
Totally. That's a good point. But also I think there is something to like rock and roll aesthetic and life and like punk aesthetic where that was still even like, that was how the Rolling Stone article framed it. Right. And that was like a new thing. And that was something again, like on a wider stage. And it's interesting to think that like, I remember watching the reaction at that time and being like, I have no idea what's going to happen here. Like, is everyone going to like react really shittily? Is everyone going to like, I don't know. I remember when like Mitch, you ever read the webcomic Nothing Nice to Say? Mitch Clem?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. All righty. He was a funny awesome. He wrote this like webcomic punk about like punk life in the 2000s. That's like funny and hilarious. I'll send you a link. Yeah. There's some funny stuff in there. You know, I remember like you, for example, just like responded positively to Laura Jane. I just remember like randomly being like, oh shit, like I never would have imagined a world where like this dude is like supporting Laura Jane. Like, that's great. And so when you talk about like, would there be more like shit in discourse now? Yeah, I do wonder about that because this was also before the time where like it was at a point where a lot of people were happy to not reject trans people out of hand, where there was such a thing possible, I think, is that like a lot of people could be like, oh, okay, that's cool. Like, you know, whatever. But it was also before the right-wing backlash, and it was before the discourse, right? It was before there was like a liminal space, I think, just strictly speaking in terms of mass culture and pop culture. Just to caveat that, strictly speaking about those, about that lens of things, where it was before the backlash, but it was also at a point where that didn't just get you immediately dismissed out of hand and just kind of, you know, kicked out of society as a crazy person, quote unquote, you know? Right. So, I mean, like, I don't know. It didn't feel this way at the time, I don't think. But in retrospect, it does feel like there was a liminal space that Transgender Dysphoria Blues entered and got to fill in some blank slates on. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah, it did. I mean, it was like...
Yeah, it would be different. It would definitely be different if it got released now.
I mean, I think if that Rolling Stone article comes out today, then next week... in the Republican presidential primary, it's a question in the debate, right?
You're right. That's exactly the right way to put it. Yeah, totally.
Like, I don't know. I think that's why I like that I have this vivid memory of when I read it, is because I do remember just reading it and just being like, I'm just taking in information about an artist I know. And I'm certain there are people who listened to them before, friends or acquaintances or whatever, who stopped listening to them after that or had feelings. I don't have memories of like being among people that are just like, fuck that shit. Well, like it didn't even.
Yeah, whatever. It's fucking weird. Yeah, totally. I don't remember that either. I don't, you know, if whatever, to whatever degree it was around, I didn't witness it.
Yeah, same. They might've just peeled off and listened to other things. And that's why they were at a smaller venue when they came back to Winnipeg. And that's how it plays out. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not, but it's interesting to think about where it is now and I guess honestly, really, if it's not like just that issue has become this way, it could just be a product of the fact that everything is this way also now. That oversimplifies it too, but.
Two coffins for sleep. One for you, one for me. We'll get there eventually. In the dark of our graves, our bodies will decay.
I went to a Jeff Rosenstock show about 2 weeks ago in Seattle. And I didn't go in the pit. And I was like, it was one of the times I was like really, really excited at the show. I'm also 40. But it was one of these moments where I was like, man, that is full of kids that are like, there is some level of just, I don't know. I don't want to like, you wrote this book about contemplating the idea of community, but there's some level of like, I'm going to go in and I'm sort of leaning on a bunch of other people to just kind of carry them around. And there's something that you're all doing together that has, I mean, I don't want to get all poetic about what a mosh pit is, but I remember for a solid 10 years of my life, that being a really comforting thing to do.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Totally. Right. Completely. Yeah. And I mean, and I think you could, and I like, I think it's like, you can really tell the truth of that whenever like you're randomly, the few times you're in a pit that like has bad vibes, right?
Yes,
like everyone's been in the pit now and then where there's like, oh, there's someone in here who just wants to hurt people and that sucks.
For sure.
And that speaks to how like most of the time it's not like that. And there is something like beautiful about that, right? For sure. And like, yeah, like there is some, I mean, like what teenager doesn't feel something powerful about that, right? That they can go and kind of get like, get roughed up a little bit and like rough themselves and like rough other people up a little bit, but in this sort of like healthy communal, like
in a
nourishing like, way.
There's just an understood level of like buy-in that everyone's kind of together in this, that it's the closest you're going to get to that process of like exerting energy in that way.
Yeah.
That you can kind of just trust until you can't. I mean, you know, it can go poorly, like you're saying, but
yeah. But I think it's kind of that, but I think like the exceptions kind of prove the rule, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, yeah, as a teenager, you know, because I was trans, there was probably an added element of that. There was probably an added layer of that, but also it was probably just a teenager who wanted to, you know, get slammed around a bit too.
I like had a few drinks at this show I went to in Seattle by myself. Like I was on like a work trip, mm-hmm. and it was like, I probably had like a 3-song arc during the show that was like, I should just go do that for like one song just to kind of do it. And then like kind of having the like really, really peaceful feeling of like, I did that and I liked that. And look at that. They're doing that. That's like,
they should do that.
They don't need me there doing that. And that's like, I think the reason that's not actually a hard thing for me to like get to, you know, like it takes me longer to recover from injuries and stuff now, but like, but it still was a level of, I think it's why it was like kind of fresh in my mind, the like contemplating that the feeling of doing that was an important thing in my life for a period of time, you know, not just like,
yeah.
So I don't know. It's very cool. Well, does it feel like there's anything as it relates to this record and this stuff that I haven't asked you that you'd want to talk about? No need to, but.
Okay, this is maybe a little cheesy, but one thing I remember very well from that show was how fucking stoked Laura Jane seemed to be to play. Like, she was having so much fun at that show.
Really?
Yeah. Like, she was having a great time.
That's cool. And
I mean, I've only seen Against Me once, you know, and I, like, rarely heard anybody say, like, yeah, man, went to Against Me show, it was okay.
It's,
I don't know, I just remember how happy she looked.
There's a sort of looseness to the way they play and everything that just feels like, It translates to a live show about as great as any band could. And in that specific moment, I think it's so cool that you got out to a show. And I love hearing that there was like sort of just visibly felt like a positive, happy, shared thing. That's awesome.
Yeah. Me too. They're good vibes.
I'm really glad that crossed paths for this and appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Of course. It was really good to do this with you, Justin. Thank you. Thank you for having me on here.
Where can people find you, whether it's just online to follow what you're up to or to read stuff you've written?
Yeah. So if you go to caseyplett.com, CaseyPlett, there's links to the 4 books that I've written. I've written 3 books of fiction and then 1 nonfiction book, the community book that you were talking about. And then on the socials, I'm also just, I'm Casey Plett on Blue Sky. And on Instagram, I am Plettsky, Plettsky. You can find out what I'm up to around there.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
If you would like to support the creation of this show, you can go to patreon.com/afterthedeluge. And for any other information, you can go to delugepodcast.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you again, Casey Plett. If you enjoyed this conversation, please share it with a friend.